You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there have been a lot of shipwrecks in the course of human history, some famous, many more forgotten. The Lusitania during World War I played a part in world history. Here in the Midwest, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lives on in legend and song. But the Titanic looms large over the history of shipwrecks. In his new book, our next guest shares the story not just of the Titanic, but of the people who obsessed over it, quested to find its remains and to bring them up to the surface, in some cases even claimed to own the wreck. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an interest in shipwrecks? Are you curious about them? Have you seen one up close? Maybe we've got a few different museums around the Great Lakes that show remains of shipwrecks. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your own memories, your questions for our guests. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure and a senior editor for National Geographic. He's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Will you start off with a little quiz you give people? I know the answer already. I cheated. I read the book. You ask people how many shipwrecks they think there are out there in the seas. And I think I can guarantee anybody who's coming up with a number is probably too low. Could you give us a sense of the scope of shipwrecks?
Yeah, I've asked this question to hundreds of people over the past few years, and everyone is wrong. When we think of how many shipwrecks there are in the world, we usually think of the big ones, the Titanic, the Lusitania, as you mentioned. But we forget that for centuries, this is how people transported themselves and goods all over the world. And so the number, according to UNESCO, about 10 years ago, is actually 3 million shipwrecks in the oceans, lakes, and rivers all over the world.
Now, the Titanic, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the attention. And it wasn't, you write, the biggest or the deadliest shipwreck of all time. So what is it about the wreck of the Titanic that made it such a big thing that we're still talking about it to this day?
Well, you're right. There's almost nothing unique about the Titanic. I mean, ships had been built big before. There were a lot of ships for rich people that ferried people across the Atlantic. Even iceberg strikes were very common in the 1880s and 90s. They had actually started to decline around the time of the Titanic. So I kind of narrowed down on this theory that the reason the Titanic has so much lasting staying cultural power is this weird quirk of a ratio of numbers. We all know that about 1,500 people died on the Titanic, but also about 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who ended up living another 50, 60, 70 years telling and retelling the stories of that night. And storytelling is what keeps kind of the cultural lore of any event alive. And in that case, kept the Titanic alive enough to be reinvented in movies, books, and museum exhibits for more than a century.
Now, your book is not just about the Titanic, but about the people who've gotten obsessed with it over the years. Can we throw you in with that category? Was there something that just like got you so interested, obsessed with hearing these stories?
I have resisted being a shipwreck obsessive, but I think I am. I love these wrecks. There's so many around the world. I fixated on the Titanic since I was a boy, as most young people do. It's just a great story. I did my science project when I was in first grade on floating and sinking and figuring out why some things float and why they don't. I frankly still struggle to understand, you know, the viscosity of materials and how ships are built. It's an endless world of mystery and intrigue, especially when you get to old ships and wrecks carrying buried treasure and you know, races for lost shipwrecks. It really gets fascinating.
Talking to Daniel Stone, his new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in if you share his curiosity about the Titanic and other shipwrecks. If you have a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, of course, I'd heard about the Titanic. I didn't really know about this world of people who, over the years, tried to find it. And once it was found, tried to bring it up. You talked to some of the people. Give us a sense of the scope from the like amateurs and maybe weirdos, we might say, to the professionals and all points in between. There's a lot of people who've done this stuff.
Yeah, almost immediately after the Titanic sank, there was this effort to try to find it and salvage it, raise it up. And, you know, for people in the early 20th century who had no experience doing this, this didn't seem that outlandish, right? There was one guy named Charles Smith in 1914, 2 years after the Titanic sank, who said, I'm just going to go to the wreck site, or I'm going to go to the site where it went down. I'm going to drop a few electromagnets in the water. They're going to attract themselves to the ship. They're going to attach themselves, and then we'll just pull them up as though it would be that easy. And the 20th century is filled with people like Charles Smith who start to imagine this goal. They think it's fascinating. They think there's a lot of fame and fortune to be gained for whoever finds and raises the Titanic. And they keep getting defeated. They have these wild plans of, you know, finding the ship and putting ping pong balls in the ship or foam that'll float it to the surface. And they keep getting pushed back, mostly because they're amateurs. You know, ship salvage is a real industry, but for people who just love wrecks, they don't have the equipment, the knowledge, and the experience really to pull up a ship, let alone one as big as the Titanic, 2.5 miles deep.
Now, you had kind of an obsession trying to meet the man who owned the wreck of the Titanic, or at least told the world that he owned it. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, this is a funny story of the Titanic, and this man, his name's Doug Woolley, is the central character of my book, very colorful character, who basically decides as a young boy in the 1940s that he wants to own the Titanic that's underwater. And he goes through this elaborate legal process when he becomes a young man, and he puts ads in newspapers. And eventually he gets to a point where nobody objects. You know, the wreck is underwater. Nobody knows where it is. No one's going to fight him on it. And so he spends most of the 60s, 70s, and 1980s claiming that he owns the wreck. And he plans to go find it. He plans to corral a team together to go salvage it. And this is written up in newspapers all over the world, in every country, as this man who owns the wreck. And Doug Woolley is still alive. He's 86, lives in England. I went to visit him. He still thinks it's possible. And I kind of realized that this was the North Star of his life. And the Titanic was something he really wanted to go save. But at almost every point of his life, the Titanic kept reinventing Doug Woolley and saving his life instead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, this is a great topic. I have my 9-year-old son has been obsessed with the Titanic for at least 2 years. He has a poster and Legos with a really awesome Titanic ship. There's so many unbelievable stories about that tragedy. I don't know if they're actually true. Like, one was there was a, you know, sailor who was told at the last minute not to go, but he had the key to the room where the lookout people would have normally been able to see the iceberg with the binoculars, but the room was locked with the binoculars that they normally would have used. And that's why they didn't see it sooner. And my son has these I Survived book series about natural or historical tragedies that occur throughout the world. And this whole thing, he's been a huge history buff, but the Titanic really was the thing that jump-started his interest in history.
Interesting, Brian. A couple of things there, Daniel. First of all, that legend. There are lots of legends about the Titanic. You were just talking about Doug Woolley. He had a family legend that he had a couple of relatives who, at the last minute, had a premonition that something bad was going to happen, didn't get on the ship. I don't think that was confirmed. There's a lot of these stories out there.
Yeah, almost endless stories. I haven't heard that specific one about the binoculars. It sounds like something that would have happened aboard the Titanic. But to your caller's point, I mean, the amount of folklore and urban legends that sometimes are facts, sometimes not, but inspire this next generation. I mean, a 9-year-old today, was not even alive at the 100th anniversary of the Titanic and is still deeply inspired. That's beautiful and kind of speaks to his sense of history and putting himself in its place.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about shipwrecks? Why ships sink? What happens when they do? Are you personally curious, like our caller's kid was, about shipwrecks? Is there one that intrigues you in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone about his new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in with your questions, your own shipwreck curiosities, Titanic or otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I was intrigued many years ago after reading a book about the fact that gold heavily laden on ships was, of course, very highly prized, and there wasn't really a good way to get it from California during the gold rush to the New York banks. The only way that it could be shipped was to go around the tip of South America and then off all the way up the coastline, all the way to New York. And that the building of the Panama Canal was really because of the ease of transportation of gold. And I thought you would be interested in that because so many ships laden heavily with gold have been found all along the South American coastline on the east and west sides, and, of course, along the whole eastern seaboard. The building of the Panama Canal was so important for the transportation of gold.
Interesting. Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. And then you reference there's a lot of gold, or has been over the years, from not just the California gold rush, but from the Spanish galleons taking gold across one ocean or another.
Yeah, especially, Rob, down by the coast of Florida is often called the Treasure Coast, from those specific two eras, the gold rush and one very large wreck that sank there in 1857 called the SS Central America, often called the Ship of Gold. And then all of the Spanish ships that were in Central and South America during the period of colonization, you know, getting and pilfering as much as they could, and they'd bring that treasure up along the coast of Florida and often get caught in storms. And so one of the most valuable shipwrecks ever found, the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, went down right around Florida. It was found in the 1970s with several $100 million of gold on board. And it's believed there's many galleons still out there, many in those waters.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Cody joins us now in Chautauqua. Cody, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cody?
So I was just curious, when it comes to shipwrecks, when a ship goes down, is it like a free-for-all for whoever wants to go explore it can go down there and maybe grab stuff or see what's going on with it? Or are there laws that prohibit people from going there and like disrupting it from where its resting place is? Because not only with the Titanic, but another one that I'm familiar with and I follow a lot with the history of is the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was just curious as is to if people are not allowed to bother with it where it sits at the bottom of the lake or the ocean floor.
Cody, thanks a lot for that call. You wrote something to the effect of, Dan, the most important piece of technology for somebody looking for shipwrecks is a really good legal team.
Exactly. And this is a great question from Cody that has a kind of a long answer. I'll give a short one, which is ships are subject to very weird legal parameters, right? Ships can be built in one country, sail to another country, be carrying goods from a third country, holding people of different citizenships and nationalities. So the jurisdiction over a ship when it goes down can get very complicated very quickly. The Edmund Fitzgerald, on account of being fairly contained within the U.S. In the Great Lakes, is kind of a no-brainer and very easy. But when a ship like the Titanic goes down, or another one that's holding gold, you know, in the middle of the ocean, you often see these big races among countries to prove that they had claim over the ship and the contents of it. But often these things get very legally thorny, and the best way to go for a ship is to choose one that's old, because when it's old, the insurers, the owners, the passengers, the families, everyone has mostly died. And those are the ships that are most often given or granted to the people who find them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Stone, author of the new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Margaret joins us now in Franklin. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Margaret?
Well, it's such a wonderful show. I'm so excited because my grandson has been so interested in the Titanic, and just as the previous gentleman called and said his son was, he's been reading all the I Survived books, and I don't know where he got the interest from, but he is going on vacation with his family down to Tennessee, and from what they're telling me, there is a museum down there regarding the sinking and everything about the Titanic. So that sounded really interesting. He has to go see it. And I read a book some years ago called The Christmas Tree Ship, about the ship that used to haul Christmas trees from up north, Lake Michigan shore, down to Chicago in the 1800s. So people down there could have Christmas trees, live Christmas trees. And it sunk off of two rivers.
Yeah. Margaret, thanks for the call. We've talked about the Christmas tree ship on the show in the past. She mentioned that museum in Tennessee. A few different places have built, mostly on dry land, replicas of some or all of the Titanic, Dan.
Yeah, in Tennessee, actually in Pigeon Forge, there is a half-scale replica of the half of the Titanic, which is great to visit, especially for young people to see the ship up close. There's also one in Branson, Missouri. The first full-scale replica of the full Titanic is currently being built in a province in western China at the moment. One thing I learned while reading and learning about the Titanic is that the Titanic story is especially big in China for reasons I still don't know. But the movies, all of the James Cameron movie and many of the movies that have been made about the Titanic do especially well in China. And they love this story there and can't get enough.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. PJ joins us now in Appleton. PJ, hi.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was in high school, my brother was fireman, oiler, water tender, shipping out of the Merchant Marine and to Russia, a lot of different places. But at one point, he was shipping out on ore boats in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that same time, they came out with that song that you've mentioned, the boat and the ship and the song. And my mama couldn't listen to it. We'd have to turn the radio off when that one came on.
PJ, thanks so much for sharing that. And that brings me to something I wanted to bring up, Dan, that I took away from your book. You know, nowadays we might go on a cruise on a ship for fun. Our biggest worry might be our blood sugar from the sweet drinks on it or whatever. Through most of history, up to pretty recently, going to sea is really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this was a extremely deadly way to travel, and really the only way to travel to another country for almost all of human history. And we have stories of people who made it across oceans, right, like Columbus or Da Gama. But we forget the many, many millions of people who died on ships. And so it's only recently, and it's kind of a sign of the technology of our modern era, that when we think of relaxing or having a vacation, we think of going on large boats, in some cases through the same waters where some of the biggest shipwreck accidents have been through history. And we don't really think much of it. And I will say that that's, you know, kind of a triumph of technology. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often that we see these accidents anymore. We still have accidents of cruise ships and container ships much less often and much less deadly.
Now, here's you also look into the sort of the physics and mechanics of a shipwreck. And here's something that struck me, right? I think of a ship like the Titanic slowly settling down to the ocean floor. Wrong. Like 30 mile per hour impact. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Titanic split in half on the surface, and the bow fell a lot faster, almost like a missile, 30 miles an hour. They scientists have figured this out by looking at the current wreck site and reverse engineering how everything got where it was. But yeah, once a ship, which is of course lighter than the water it displaces, that's what helps it float. Once it takes on water, it becomes heavier, and it can become a lot heavier than the water. And when it has a trajectory of 2 miles or more, like the Titanic to sink, its terminal velocity could be as high as 30 or even more miles per hour.
All right, I got to ask, after spending years pursuing the stories of shipwrecks, are you more or less likely to want to spend time on a boat at sea?
Oh, I get horribly, horribly seasick. I can't even be on a kayak or canoe. And one of my great fears of writing this book is, you know, to become a shipwreck expert and invited on cruises to talk about it and just, you know, reveal my extreme antipathy to ships. I love ships. I just can't handle being on them.
No offense. If I operate a cruise ship line, I'm probably not going to invite the shipwreck author.
There you go. Exactly.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Daniel Stone, author on science and adventure, senior editor for National Geographic. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic, about mainly the Titanic and the people who looked to find its remains over the years, bring them up. A lot of human stories involved in that. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, making new friends can be really hard, especially as a grown-up. And keeping up those existing friendships as life changes can be a big challenge, too. Our next guest says the science of attachment can teach us a lot about our own strengths and weaknesses as friends and what we look for in friendships. And she's got advice to make it easier to find new friends and to be a good friend to the ones you've got. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a friendship in your life that's really been important to you? What works for maintaining close friendships in your own life? Have you found ways to make new friends, or is it a challenge for you like it is for a lot of people? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marissa G. Franco is an assistant clinical professor of university honors at the University of Maryland. She's the author of the new book, Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Marissa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Me.
Now, you opened the book with a personal moment for you. A romantic relationship ended. And tell us how important your friends were in rising up from that moment.
Yeah, so to heal from that at the time, I decided to start this wellness group with my friends where we would meditate, cook, do yoga together, and I just really felt the love from all of them, and it led me to question some ideas that I had about love, that romantic love was the only love that counted, the only love that made me worthy, that, you know, proved my value. And so I started to wonder, why doesn't platonic love matter? Like, why hasn't it mattered to me that I'm loved by all of these people? Why have I treated it like this is secondary and illegitimate, and romantic love is the only legitimate form of connection? So I sort of went on a quest to level this hierarchy of love that I think hurts people who are within and outside of romantic relationships, because it makes us really devalue friendship. And so that's part of the reason that I decided to write Platonic.
I think we all might know, yeah, having friends, that's a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. You really lay out how important friends can be in having those connections. What are some of the benefits of having good friendships?
Yeah. So loneliness is as toxic for our bodies as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And you might think, okay, but I can cure my loneliness through my spouse or my family, right? But there's actually three types of loneliness, only one in which can be met through a spouse, which is intimate loneliness, the desire for someone to have a very close connection with, like you have with a spouse or a best friend. But there's also relational loneliness. We have a desire for people that are about as close to us as a friend. And then collective loneliness, which is the desire for being part of a group that's working towards a common goal. And any of these forms of loneliness can be at play, such that even if we're very happy with our spouse, we can still end up feeling lonely because basically this suggests that we've always needed an entire community to feel truly whole.
And you share some of the numbers there. We Americans are kind of bad at this. Our numbers of friends, our friend networks are going down from year to year. What do you think is driving that?
Oh, man, so many different factors. You know, it really started with the creation of the television in the 1950s. And before then, leisure was a public affair that people did with their friends when they had free time. They just spent it with other people. But then people just started to spend their free time in front of the television. And in 2012, we also see spikes in loneliness. And that's around the time when the smartphone really became popular. And of course, there's ways to use technology to foster connection. But what it does is it has opportunity costs, right? That if we're using this technology every day for entertainment, to pass the time, we're not hanging out, which is what we would do if we were maybe more bored and didn't have this low-hanging fruit that gives us almost a snack of connection, parasocial connections. We feel connected to people we don't even know. And the snack makes us not realize just how hungry we are for the full meal of connection, the in-person interaction.
We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has friendship been an important thing in your life? Do you have a friend you want to talk about with us? Or has it been a challenge for you, maybe as you age? Spend more time with your family. Is it harder to make and keep friendships? Or have you moved someplace new? What worked? What didn't work with making new friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marissa, let's get to work. In that situation, somebody's thinking, yeah, gosh, I want more friends, but you don't want to just walk up to another grown-up and say, will you be my friend? How do we get started?
Yeah, the first thing is we have to let go of the idea that friendship happens organically. Mm-hmm. As adults, it does not. As kids, we have these ingredients: continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. We see people every day. We let our guard down through gym, recess, right? And that's what fosters organic connection. As adults, we no longer are inhabiting settings like that, right? At work, we see people every day, but we usually are not particularly vulnerable with our colleagues. So that means that you can't rely on friendship happening organically. In fact, doing so is related to being more lonely over time. And you're going to have to initiate. Now, people are very afraid of initiating, but I like to share with people, the research actually finds people are less likely to reject you than you think. There's research on a phenomenon called the liking gap, wherein when strangers interact and are asked to predict, how much do you think the other person likes you? We tend to underestimate just how liked we are. The more self-critical we are, the more pronounced this underestimation. So I suggest assume people like you. Because according to other research on something called the acceptance prophecy, when people are told that they'll go into a group and be liked based on their personality profile, and that even if this is a lie, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it makes people warmer, friendlier, more engaged.
On a practical level, so we know somebody at work or a friend of a friend or whatever, what are some ways to build that relationship in a friendshiply direction?
Yeah. So, right, I talked about the problem at work being that we only show one dimension of us. A great way to bring out multiple dimensions of us is something called repotting, which was created by Ryan Hubbard at the Kite String Project. And that's the idea of varying the settings in which we interact, right? So stop interacting at work, stop talking about work, like share who you are as a real person, say to them like, oh, it's been so nice to like get to know you at work. Like, would you want to go for a walk after work? Or, you know, I was going to go to the museum this weekend. Would you be up for that? Right. And that also makes the friendship more sustainable. People complain, well, when the work is over, we no longer see each other. But once you have precedent for seeing each other, even when you're not in the working hours, it's going to be easier to maintain it if there's transitions as well.
Now, you write about the psychology of our attachment styles. What is an attachment style and how does it affect our friendship journeys?
Yeah, great question. So attachment style is basically a template we have for how people will treat us that we create in childhood and update throughout life. And this template we have, this expectation for how other people will treat us, is ridden with confirmation bias, such that we see in the world things that match our expectation and discount experiences that don't match it. So there's three major attachment styles. Secure people. Their template is people are trustworthy. They'll love me. They'll accept me. And that means they behave in ways that reflect this template. They are open, vulnerable, better at initiating friendships, less likely to end friendships, according to the research. They move away from people that aren't nice and aren't friendly. They're just very comfortable with themselves. They assume people like them, right? Versus anxiously attached people whose template is people are going to abandon you. So how do they navigate friendships because of that? They move very quickly, are sort of like overshare from the beginning, tend to have these very fragile friendships. They assume they're being rejected even when they're not. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because then they try to reject because they think they're rejected. And they sort of manifest their greatest fears because of that. And then you have avoidantly attached people who are also afraid of abandonment and fundamentally think others are untrustworthy. So how do they handle these fears? The avoidantly attached people, they keep to themselves. They're the lone wolves. They're never vulnerable. They're not really trying in their friendships. They end up ghosting more than other attachment styles. People feel like I'm around him, but I don't actually know him because he never actually shares anything about himself. They suppress their emotions. They're very uncomfortable with anyone else's emotions. So conflict is a big fear of them. They can be sort of people pleasing so they don't have to face some emotions in others.
We're talking to psychologist Marissa G. Franco about her new book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Kind of surprised. I guess we don't have friends in Wisconsin. Do you have a story of friendship you want to share with us? Do you need some advice from our guest on maybe making a friendship or maintaining past friendships? Love to hear from you. If you have a question, a thought, an experience you would like to share about making or maybe losing friends along the way, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in with your story of friendship, maybe a tough time in your life where you've had trouble making friends, maybe after moving or moving to a new job, say. What's worked for you? What doesn't? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm known for keeping in touch with my friends. They always talk about how great I am about doing that. I have friends from 30, 40, 45 years back that I've kept in touch with. And I think that friendship, it does take work or effort to be able to keep in touch with people and, you know, keep up with their addresses or emails or new phone numbers. But it's really worth it. And I just think that that was the important point I wanted to make.
I love it, Elizabeth. I'll tell you, you're a better friend than I am, and probably a better person too. Marissa, I'm the opposite of Elizabeth. I'm famously abysmal at keeping in touch with people, and I'm one of those people who gets, you know, I feel guilty, and I'm like, oh, it's too late. I can't, you know, I feel like an idiot if I reach out. How do we be more like Elizabeth than like me?
Yeah. Well, it's, first of all, it's lovely that you have positive intent. And Elizabeth, I'm glad that you are able to do all of those things, because I'm sure you're making other people feel so, so loved. I think part of the ways we get better at it is we change our framework for friendship. I think a lot of us have this frame of friends. It's good vibes only. It's easy. It's not that. And so it's not on our list of priorities, right? Because of how we've just been socialized and conditioned to see it. But in fact, I think I argue that there's a difference between good company and a good friend. That good company is someone whose time you enjoy. They put you in a good mood, right? You like them as a person, but that is not a good friend. To be a good friend, it's a responsibility, an investment, a commitment in another person, right? It's, I'm going to be there to support you in your times of need. I'm going to try to make you feel safe when you're vulnerable. When you succeed, I'm going to celebrate you, right? I think our framework for friends needs to be more similar to our framework for romance, which is, I need to put in time and effort, and there's times where this is going to be hard, but I also know that it's really worth it. And so it's really making friendship a priority amidst all of our other priorities.
Thanks again for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us next in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? I love your show. You know it.
Thanks.
I had to laugh when I was listening. I heard this, hi, my name is Paul. Will you be my friend? And actually, that's how my wife describes me. And I guess I'm trying to understand, is there a potential to have a combination of these friendships? In other words, I have friends that I consistently meet up with, and we go through the deeper deeps. And then I have wonderful companions, like a girl that I met in an airplane that took me all around, you know, a Caribbean island, because we just happened to talk on the plane together with my wife. I'm just curious, like, are there gray lines? You know,
Paul, I think I gotcha. We can have a variety of friends, maybe Marissa, with a variety of roles in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great question. And, you know, I think that's the beauty of friendship, that it can occur on such a spectrum, right? Like, now some people are even choosing friends for their life partners, but we also have these sort of friendly acquaintances. I also talk about in the book this idea of low-dose friends, right? There's some people that we like some parts of them, we don't like others. And you might think, oh, this person can't be my friend. But in fact, you could really enjoy their company at low doses. If you see them once a month, you're like, oh, I'm happy, that was nice. But if you see them more frequently, it's like, oh, no. And so that's the beauty of friendship. We can sort of turn the dial down or turn the dial up based off of the connection we have, the degree of compatibility that we feel. And so it can just give us so much versatility.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Talking to Marissa G. Franco. Her new book is called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Matt, hi.
Hi. Love WPR. Love the Ideas Network. I just wanted to comment really quick. You know, I was a millennial in Chicago, went to art school, had a number of bands, a couple of my bands toured the world, and we had incredible experiences together. However, like after the pandemic, we all seemed to go our separate ways, and it's been, really, really tough reestablishing some sort of connection with my former bandmates and the people that I was so close to making art with. And I just wanted to speak on that. And, you know, I really try to make an effort, and, you know, when those efforts aren't reciprocated, it can be kind of hurtful. So I just wanted to speak on that and just say, you know, continue to reach out to your good friends. And, hopefully one day you'll be able to hang out with them in the same capacity again. So thank you.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Marissa, I'm guessing Matt is very much not alone in that, you know, pandemic disruption of the life with friends. Do you have some advice for him and other people in that situation trying to rebuild?
Yeah, well, Matt, I really love your investment in your previous friendships. I think more generally, we saw in the pandemic a sort of split in how friendship was affected, right? For those people that your friendship is a companionate friendship, it's contingent on you doing activities together. It was a real blow. We couldn't do activities together. But for those people whose friendship was founded on sharing the deep, vulnerable, profound stuff, right? Reaching out when we're struggling and getting support, those friendships were a little bit more durable because we all needed support. So, hey, we were able to access them. It looks like this caller is sort of struggling because he's still invested in these friendships and his friends aren't. I think just some follow-up questions I have to ask is that, you know, we tend to devalue our friendships more if we don't see them in person. So have you tried to see these friends in person so they can sort of recognize your chemistry and your dynamic and how much they value you, right? That when we're apart from people, it's hard for us to viscerally feel that connection in the same way than when we're in person. I think it's also helpful to think about friendship as flexible, not fragile. What I mean by that is friendships ebb and flow, right? And if you're in an ebb and you assume it's fragile, then you're going to assume it's over and you're not going to reach out anymore. But it might be that this is going to flow again at another time when, you know, your friends are in a good place. So you can sort of treat it that way. That being said, I hear that it hurts when the relationships don't feel so reciprocal and you're the only one reaching out. And I also wanted to say, it'll be important to find relationships that are reciprocal, right? To find those people that are ready and available. And we tend to find those in transitioners. That's people who just moved to a city, who are going through a divorce or breakup, who just retired. They tend to be particularly open to friendship. So I think that's a good place to start.
Thanks for that call. Good luck. Hope that helps. Time for one more caller. Kimberly is with us in Arena. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So I tend to be the extroverted friend. I'm the one that's always taking my crew of introverted friends along with me because I'm making all of the decisions or, hey, let's all go out here at night. And I've just been kind of experiencing a lot of decision fatigue from that lately. And so then I end up staying home because I don't want to go out and make decisions or make everybody go someplace. So then everybody else ends up staying home.
And I
just keep going through the same cycles because then I'll be tired. We won't do anything. And then go right back to it. And we just can't seem to find a balance. I don't know.
Interesting. Kimberly, thanks for the call. Marissa, briefly, do you have advice for Kimberly to have some of those introverts get on board and organize it and make some of the decisions?
Yeah, Kimberly, I think maybe trying to automate your hangouts, like every other Wednesday, we're going to go to this restaurant or every other Wednesday, we're going to choose to go to someone's house can be a really great way to do it. The other thing I wonder is if you've made your expectations, if you have asserted them in an upfront way, right? Or if you're just sort of upset about this and hoping someone will kind of get the hint. And I think just saying something as simple as like, hey, y'all, really want to see y'all. Coordinating, being the coordinator can sometimes be hard on me. Would we be open to sort of rotating who sets up our plans and see what they say?
Good luck, Kimberly. In just our last minute or so, Marissa, rescuing the word love. I think we just think of romantic love in our society now. Make the case for thinking of love as something we have for our friends.
So there's this Italian philosopher who says platonic love is a love so beautiful that it transcends the physical. And so I think we can see that each love is beautiful. Romantic love is beautiful, but platonic love is beautiful too. And it, in its non-sexual nature, right, it provides us with its own offerings in its fluidity. It provides us with its own offerings and its versatility, right? In the fact that our friends can be an entire community, whereas for most of us, our spouse is limited to one person. It provides us with unique offerings, which make it so that friendships cannot be replaced by any other type of relationship.
Marissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Marissa G. Franco, psychologist with the University of Maryland. She's with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Hey, if you want to shout out one of your friends, we would love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org or head over and post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with a story of a friendship that's been important in your own life. At the end of every week here on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get recipes, advice, and inspiration for baking and cooking with all kinds of ingredients. That's on the air each Friday, or you can check out our archives anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out a recipe there and let us know how it goes.